The headlines: Palestinian media say Israeli forces have arrested several family members of six Palestinian inmates who managed to escape an Israeli jail on Monday. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip celebrate the escape of the inmates from Israel's Gilboa prison. And a powerful earthquake hit southwestern Mexico near the beach resort of Acapulco, leaving at least one person dead. Hello and welcome, everybody, to our top story for this half-hour. Palestinian media say Israeli forces have arrested family members of the Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison earlier this week. Reports say Israeli forces stormed the houses of the six prisoners as cellmates tunneled out of one of Israel's highest security prisons on Monday. The move was the first such jailbreak in decades in Gilboa prison's history. Israel launched a massive manhunt to arrest the six afterward. The regime set up roadblocks and deployed surveillance vehicles to aid its search. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah called the breakout a grave failure for Israeli security agencies. Palestinian groups also hailed the incident as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says Israeli troops have used threats and force against the relatives of the escaped Palestinian prisoners to get information about their whereabouts.
Up till the moment, Israeli forces are still carrying out the manhunt in search of those Palestinian prisoners, those six heroes, according to the Palestinians, who succeeded to escape from Gilboa prison, north of the lands occupied in 1948. This morning, Israeli forces raided Jenin in northern the occupied West Bank. They raided the town of Yabad and Arabi, arrested a number of the relatives of those six, arrested the father of Yaqub Enfiad, as well as brother of Mahmoud Arda, and Qasim Arda, the brother of Muhammad Arda. And several hours later, they released the father of Enfiad. However, they threatened him in case he knew anything about his son and he didn't inform the Israeli authorities or the Israeli military, then they will again storm the town, and they will not only arrest him, however, they will arrest all his family members, and said in case his son did not surrender to the Israeli forces, then the Israeli soldiers would be killing him at the end of the day.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip have hailed six prisoners who managed to escape from an Israeli jail in northeast of Al-Quds on Monday. For Palestinians, a prison break is considered as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime and its military. Ruba Shabat has more in this report from Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security jailbreak prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Gilboa prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Taliban have announced key ministers of a caretaker government in Afghanistan 3 weeks after taking over the country, including the capital, Kabul. In a press conference, Zabihullah Mujahid said Hassan Akhund has been appointed acting prime minister, while Taliban co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar will be the acting deputy premier. He said Sarojuddin Haqqani has been appointed acting interior minister. The spokesman added Amir Khan Muttari has been named acting foreign minister. Mullah Yaqub will serve as acting defense minister in the new government. Mujahid said other ministers of the caretaker government will be announced in due course. Several of the appointees are in the UN and U.S. sanctions list. Political commentator Brian Downing says the Taliban never expected to take over Kabul, adding that the group has a hard time to transform into a centralized government.
I don't think the Taliban expected to take Kabul this quickly. I think even the Taliban people have admitted, those in Kabul say, that they really wanted some sort of government in Kabul to negotiate with, to keep foreign aid coming in, and to negotiate some sort of interim government, which they would dominate, of course, but they really weren't prepared for this. Now what they have to do is they have to go from a decentralized military movement. You know, they had provincial commanders and district commanders, and they had this council that had all sorts of factions. Now they have to become a centralized government over a population that is very poor. They're not very welcome of Pashtun rule. They never really supported the Taliban. They just found it somewhat less objectionable than the Karzai and the Ghani governments.
The Taliban say their newly appointed government in Afghanistan will uphold, quote, Sharia law in all matters of governance and life. In his first message since the group rose to power, Taliban leader Hibatullah Akhundzada said the new government will start functioning at the earliest. He said the group is committed to all international laws, treaties, and commitments which are not in conflict with Islamic law. Akhundzada pledged that the new leadership would ensure lasting peace, prosperity, and development in the country. Also called on Afghans not to leave the country. The Taliban say they've taken full control of Panjshir province, where the group is fighting against the forces of the National Resistance Front led by Ahmad Massoud. However, Massoud has dismissed the announcement by the Taliban, saying his forces still hold strategic areas of Panjshir Valley. Amin Alami has a report on that.
The Taliban spokesman has declared the collapse of Panjshir Valley in the north of Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid says the war is over in Afghanistan and that there is no anti-Taliban resistance in the country, except by Daesh.
The war is ended all over Afghanistan after successfully capturing Panjshir province as the last stronghold for the ousted enemy. The Islamic Emirate forces have active presence in the valley.
However, the leader of National Resistance Front says he is in Panjshir and that his forces are deployed across the strategic areas of the valley. According to Massoud, the resistance will push ahead with its fight on the Taliban until victory is achieved. In an audio message, Massoud called on all Afghans to come together and stand against the Taliban.
I call on all my countrymen inside and abroad to launch a national uprising to defend our dignity, independence, and freedom. I also call on the international community to be aware that the Taliban has never changed.
The leader of National Resistance Front also slammed the Taliban for what he called defying the demand of a top delegation of religious scholars to engage in talks to resolve the conflict in Panjshir. He also accused Pakistan of directly invading Afghanistan, saying the Pakistani military used drones to bomb Panjshir to help the Taliban. Ahmed Massoud's claim on the Pakistani military interference in Panjshir has complicated the situation. On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman was asked about the reports of Pakistani airstrikes. The spokesman said Iran condemns all foreign interference in Afghanistan without specifying any country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A powerful earthquake has struck southwestern Mexico, leaving at least one person dead so far. The magnitude 7 quake caused rockfalls and damage to buildings. It also did damage to Acapulco. The tremor caused widespread power outages in several states. The Mexican State Power Utility said the quake affected some 1.6 million users across the country. The Mexican National Seismological Service said the epicenter was 14 kilometers southeast of the beach resort of Acapulco. A massive earthquake struck the Mexican capital in 1985, killing thousands of people. In the United States, the number of deaths from the novel coronavirus has surpassed the grim milestone of 650,000. The figure is based on data from the Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. has recorded more than 40.2 million COVID-19 cases since the beginning of the pandemic. The country is the worst hit by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Elsewhere in the Americas, Mexico logged nearly 1,100 new deaths, raising its overall death toll close to 265,000. The country also registered nearly 16,000 new cases. The World Health Organization has criticized wealthy nations for hoarding COVID-19 vaccines and treatments.
The developed world and the industrialized world just doesn't seem to get it. It really doesn't. It talks, the rhetoric is fine, it's all about sharing, it's all about fairness, but in reality, when push comes to shove and these products are available, they are hoarded in countries and they're not shared.
The criticism came at a Q&A session attended by the WHO's top epidemiologists. They described hoarding as an immoral and unfair practice that's prolonging the pandemic. The UN Health Agency has set a target for countries to vaccinate at least 10% of their population by the end of this month. It has called on wealthier nations to halt booster vaccine shots to help poorer countries meet the target. According to the UN, nearly 60% of the population of the European Union has been fully inoculated. In contrast, Africa has only vaccinated 3% of its population. A new poll shows that Americans have become warier about intrusive government spying in the name of national security. A poll conducted by the Associated Press found that about two-thirds of Americans are opposed to the possibility of warrantless monitoring of telephone calls, emails, and text messages made within the country. According to the poll, about half are opposed to government monitoring of internet searches, including those by U.S. sanctions without a warrant. The survey shows that Americans were less concerned about government surveillance more than 20 years ago, when the U.S. started so-called war on terror by invading Afghanistan and later Iraq. Past revelations regarding the widespread monitoring of U.S. people on social media has made the public distrustful of the authorities.
We have Julian Assange, we have Cambridge Analytica when it comes to Facebook, and we have just a general distrust of each other in general as we face a polarized nation which is split behind political ideological lines. So if you factor all of these things in, and many more which I have not named, you start to make more sense off of why more people feel more distrustful of the government. We also have to remember that we had a former president who also talked a lot about fake news, and we looked at just how different types of misinformation and disinformation are feeding into the cultural ethos of the country. And when you look at just some of the failures of our U.S. intelligence system, more people are saying, well, we're not so trustful of the systems that we've traditionally had a lot of faith and confidence in the past. Not only that, we're more reliant on digital services. We are using our computers more. We're using smart speakers more. I even failed to say the name because I know it will alert one in my house right now if I say that special call word that has been heavily commercialized. That's because we all, or many of us, have these digital systems, smart speakers, that are already entrenched in our daily lives. And to have the government further build upon that, it seems a lot more threatening and people are a lot more distrustful.
NATO has accused Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran of breaking international rules with respect to arms control. Critics, however, have pointed out to the 30-nation alliance hypocrisy given its conduct in nations such as Afghanistan. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes at NATO headquarters, Brussels.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 8, 2010. I saw nothing but beauty, Zainab al-Kubra. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, O God, accept this sacrifice from us. When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, I did not see anything but beauty. All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana latshan.
Imam Hussain, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Zainab entered the heart of threats for the sake of Allah the Exalted. February 8, 2010. What Zainab did was divine. That is to say, she went into the heart of threats and hardships for the sake of Allah the Exalted. It behooves us to know and to understand our glorious religious history, which has been a source of intellectual blessings so far, and which will hopefully benefit us until the end of time. Zainab played an unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussain, on the day of Ashura, with all those hardships, and after Imam Hussain had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted, and this is something that we cannot describe.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On April 7, 2018, an alleged chemical weapon attack in the city of Douma, Syria, killed at least 50 people. The suspected chemical attack involved two chlorine cylinders dropped from a Syrian Air Force helicopter. Following the incident, the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations said that the symptoms of the casualties were consistent with exposure to a nerve agent. Almost a week later, the United States accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons containing chlorine and the nerve agent sarin to bombard Douma, Syrian President Bashar Assad accused the US, UK and France of staging the attack in Douma, saying the attack did not take place. He called the whole incident a lie and called on the Western governments to provide evidence for the accusations. Also, after a group of Russian specialists tested Douma's soil samples, Moscow confirmed that the results showed no presence of substances containing chlorine or any sort of nerve agents in Douma. Russia also confirmed that Douma's hospitals had not received any patients with symptoms of exposure to sarin or chlorine. On April 14th, hours before the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission team arrived in Damascus, the US, UK and France conducted missile strikes against the Syrian government. Former US President Donald Trump claimed Washington seeks to establish a deterrent against the production, spread and use of chemical weapons. However, the Syrian Foreign Ministry denounced the attacks as barbaric aggression. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. Western governments, the US in particular, have used different ways from proxies and direct involvement to crippling economic sanctions to oust the Syrian government, yet they have failed. Now, the BBC has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syria contained serious inaccuracies. The BBC says it had no evidence to back up a claim that a former chemical weapons inspector, in exchange for money, had expressed doubts over the conclusion that the attack was carried out by Damascus. That could justify the reason why war on Syria has continued for this long.
Well, the war on Syria was always based on lies, on complete fabrications, repeated endlessly. They were, from the very beginning, an attempt to pull down, totally dismember Syria. They were part of the U.S. and Western Allied war in the whole region, also against Iraq, the continuing threats on Iran, the destruction of Libya. So Syria was very much a part of this, and the fact that they've absolutely failed in this effort, now, like, you know, a can of worms, the truth begins to sort of ooze out, because they're not willing to continue the war. They see what the U.S. complete defeat in Afghanistan led to. So I think that's why the exposés now. But this was always a lie, and from the beginning, it was very thoroughly debunked.
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in the Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that a former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest expose in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war. And that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth. Next Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center buildings in New York City. The attacks resulted in tragic death of nearly 3,000 people, while thousands more were injured. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have refused to release classified documents related to the investigations of the September 11th terrorist attacks. The documents reportedly could expose a potential link between Saudi Arabia and the hijackers, as 15 out of 19 alleged attackers were Saudi nationals. Also, publicly released documents, including by the 9/11 Commission, have detailed numerous Saudi entanglements, but failed to prove government complicity. The Saudi government has routinely denied any connections to the attacks. In recent months, pressure has mounted on the Biden administration as families of the 9/11 victims demand answers in regard to Saudi government's role in the terrorist attacks on the U.S. soil. Last month, nearly 1,800 Americans directly affected by the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center called on U.S. President Joe Biden to skip the 20th anniversary events unless he upholds his pledge to declassify evidence that could link Saudi Arabia to the attack. President Biden is currently facing sharp criticism over his administration's response to the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country after 20 years of war. It seems, in a bid to deflect the criticism and the pressure on his shoulders, Biden finally gave in and signed an executive order which directs the Justice Department and other federal agencies to begin a review of documents and release declassified information over the next 6 months. U.S. officials assert that Al-Qaeda terrorists carried out the 9/11 attacks. However, many experts and independent researchers have questioned the official account. They believe that rogue elements within the U.S. government orchestrated or at least encouraged the 9/11 attacks in order to accelerate the U.S. war machine and advance the Zionist agenda.
I think it is implausible to believe that 19 people, most of whom didn't speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, many of whom didn't have a high school education, could have carried out such a complicated task without some support from within the United States.
Bob Graham and others believe that the United States has deliberately shielded the Saudi Arabia by refusing to expose their links to the attacks in order to protect the Washington-Riyadh relationship. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports between 2016 and 2020. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Furthermore, U.S. President Joe Biden has previously refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, I don't know. The Saudis will definitely react. Whether the United States will do anything, I don't know. I think that the implication here is that we would reduce arms sales or something like that. But, you know, there's such pressures on the economy to maintain the arms sales that I think that there will be some comments, there will be efforts by the Progressive Caucus in the Democratic Party to rein in the Saudis. But I think in the end, unless the real leadership in the State Department and the CIA decides that the Saudis are too much of a price to pay, that other than comments, nothing is going to happen.
Washington has been shielding Riyadh for the 9/11 attacks for two decades. What's for sure is that the lucrative alliance with the Saudis and the kingdom's green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan,
The world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as the safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us, 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, you know, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Regarding the approach of Dr. Ayati in his book, he's trying to put some lines between the authentic stories in the history and the non-authentic or fake stories in the history. Also, he is giving some evidences regarding the time and the era of Muawiyah, that why Islamic society is going to kill the grandson of His Holiness.
The work of Mr. Ayati will be fall in historical war. And specifically with respect to his work, investigation into the history of Ashura, we might say that the dominant context of his work is historical war.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. In the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with the outstanding figures and dignitaries in the world of Islam, especially the Shia scholars in the field of jurisprudence, history, hadith, and theology. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two Islamic experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziainia. We want to start our discussion regarding one of the greatest outstanding Shia scholars, the late Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati. Sheikh Ziainia, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, regarding the Islamic history and the Shia history, Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati is one of the most outstanding figures who has translated also many books from Arabic into Persian language. Unfortunately, we missed him very soon, so many years before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, but he is still considered in the research circles and the academic circles of the Islamic houses as one of the most outstanding clergymen who has also got his PhD in the field of Islamic philosophy from the University of Tehran, and also was active in the field of teaching at the University of Tehran in those days, in his time. Sheikh Mahdavi, give us a background and introductory remarks regarding the late Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Late Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati was born in 1914 in one of the villages of Birjand called Ghazar.
Okay.
After a while, after he joined, at that time we had the concept of Maktab to learn Islamic studies and literature and the other stuff that the students would learn. After a while, he moved from the village to the city, Birjand, which is located at the southeast of Mashhad.
That's right.
Which is the main city at the northeast of Iran.
Very good.
After he finishes and completes his studies in Mashhad, he moves to Tehran.
That's right.
And in Tehran, he is given the chair to teach Islamic philosophy, and also at the same time he holds the PhD in the field of philosophy that you also mentioned.
Islamic philosophy, it says.
Yes, Islamic major. Philosophy.
Okay.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, his life was not that long.
Yes, unfortunately.
In an accident, he died around 1343.
That's right, according to solar calendar.
Yes,
according. That's right. In a car accident, unfortunately.
This is the timeline of his life.
Okay.
And with respect to his works, if we wanted to talk about the works that he contributed to the Islamic library, we might say he is considered one of the historians of his time, because he is mainly known with his historical works. We have Barresiya Tarikh Ashura, which is investigating the history of Ashura, and another book also. Three works of his works are concerning the concept of Ashura, uprising of Ashura.
That's right. Okay.
And the other works that mainly are pertaining the issue of history, analytical aspect of history.
So he was merely concerned with the history of Islam, especially as Shahid Mutahari says, he was an expert in the first century
of the early Islam and all the events and the, we can say, historical facts that took place in that period. Okay?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Ziyaneh, let's get to you. Islamic history itself is a very interesting field of study. And we know that especially the Shia school of thought, whenever it wants to get back to its origin and the sources, according to the narrations, ahadith, and the events, they get into authentic resources regarding Islamic history and Shia history. People like the late Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati, I think, can help us very much in this regard, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, as you mentioned, and my respected brother Sheikh Mahdavi also had some points, having these figures to write about history is very important, because a historian that is only as a historian,
that's right,
maybe sometimes cannot adjust Islamic events correctly as it has happened in the history.
That's right.
Because Islamic events has its context. Mm-hmm. And if you want to find it correctly, you need to find the context also.
Very good.
So if somebody as Mr. Ayati, who is an expert in Islamic studies also, if he wants to work on history, his work would be for sure different with the one who is just a historian.
That's right.
This is a very important point. And regarding Mr. Ayati, also this point is notable, that he studied as a student of Sheikh Mirza Mahdi Isfahani, Ayatollah Mirza Mahdi Isfahani in Mashhad. Of course, although he studied as his student, but he got his PhD in Islamic philosophy.
And we know that that person, that scholar, was totally against philosophy, isn't it?
Yes, somehow totally, or okay, at least he was not agree with philosophy.
Yes.
And this point was attracting me regarding the personality of late Dr. Ayati, that, you know, he had this free will and determined to choose himself.
That's
and
right.
It shows that he was, you know, personality, a figure that he himself as a researcher was searching and trying to find the truth, and then trying to go the way that he was believing in.
That's right.
With respect to his teachers. So this is important point about him. And of course, before going to the university, he studied philosophy.
Yes.
He studied Al-Isharat and also Al-Shifa from Abu Ali Sina.
That's
and
right.
Also Al-Asbar al-Arba'ah.
Okay.
Another important point regarding his works is that, yes, he is a historian, but the most important point regarding his work in history is that he was trying to differ between the authentic resources in history and the fake or weak resources in history.
That's right.
And in the book, Barisi Tariqa Ashura, and also the
An investigation into the history of the day of Ashura.
Yes.
Okay.
Regarding this book, also he tries this, and also regarding the life of the Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that he wrote this book before the Islamic Revolution, and before he could publish this book, he passed away during the accident, and the book was published after his demise.
That's right.
And after the Islamic Revolution, his book won the prize of the Book of the Year of the Islamic Revolution.
And the first year after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he won the prize as the Book of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and this has been very important. You know, a person like Allama Mutahhari, Shahid Mutahhari, talks in admiration about the late Dr. Ayati and says that truly he was one of the genius scholars regarding Islamic history, especially the first century of Islam, and the methodology, I mean the method of the research of the late Ayati attracted many people on that time, which show that, as Sheikh Ziyaneh said, in what context the Islam was developing or had its own shortcomings and fallback, especially during the time of Bani Umayyah, I mean Umayyads, and at the time of Yazid, what happened and in what context Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam got martyred. So, Sheikh Mahdavi, what other information can you give us about the details of his life, I mean, the late Ayati.
One of the main contributions that late Dr. Ayati had with respect to the concept of Ashura, or topic of Ashura, we may say that he was so much concerned about the superstitions and not true stories which were circulating from this speech to another speech, okay, from this community to another community.
Regarding Imam al-Hussein.
Yes, okay. Regarding Imam Hussein and his companions.
Yes.
All of us, even right now today, we might hear here and there,
yes,
that many things that has no root in the, yes, history and first-hand resources.
Okay.
So one of the things that he did, because he was so much concerned with this issue, to remove and purify this history from these false stories. So in order to do that, he established an institute in the University of Tehran in order to teach students of Hausa, or all those people who would deliver speeches.
So was it a religious center?
Yeah, in some sense you may say it, because, yes, the institute was entitled Mu'assise Wa'ad Watabliq, meaning that the Institute of Delivering Speeches and Preaching, okay, Islam.
That's right.
So preaching Islam, mm-hmm, all people who are, yes, religious, yes, do preaching of
it
Islam.
It seems to be very much difficult on that time,
yes,
before the Islamic, and inside the University of Tehran, which
to establish
to be,
such, yeah, entity.
With the rational sciences, they were concerned, literature, yes, and rationality.
But he, okay, did it in order,
okay,
to,
that's right, great,
have this contribution,
okay,
for the issue of Ashura, the,
right,
stories, false stories, mm-hmm, that were going from this,
right,
masjid to another masjid,
mm-hmm,
and people,
that's right,
would treat these stories as a true thing and exaggerating,
that's right,
about the concept of Ashura.
So I think, so, I think in this way, so he influenced Shahid Mutahhari too, because most of the research of Shahid Mutahhari regarding Imam al-Hussein exactly followed this type of research method. I mean, in Husseini epic or Tahrifat Ashura or Vikas Ashura distortions, he is trying to purify and remove this and that superstition and stories from the event of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein. Okay, yeah, great.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Most of the historians, I mean, follow this way because they are concerned with the historical facts and the realities that took place in the scene. So somehow their mind and their intellect are realistic. So for a researcher and a historian of Islam like the late Ayati, I think this method must bear much fruit, isn't it, Sheikh Zainia?
Yes, and if we want to trace back the reason of this approach of Mr. Ayati and of also Martyr Mutahhari and some other figures on that in on those times,
yes,
we may come to this result that maybe they had chosen this approach because the opposition, maybe,
mm-hmm,
the ones who were somehow modernists,
yes,
they were trying to challenge the event of Karbala and the movement of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, because the modernists try to challenge the traditional beliefs always,
okay,
and they say that we should change everything.
And some of them believe that religion and belief is something very low-graded and belongs to the masses and ordinary people. And that's why the modern sciences are maybe higher than the religious,
yes,
studies.
Yes.
But people like Ayati showed that, no, we can look at the religion and the Islamic studies and Islamic history as a separate academic field too. Is,
yeah,
it so?
Yeah, okay, that was the point that I'm trying to say,
okay,
that exactly he chose this approach,
mm-hmm,
to differentiate between the falsehoods,
okay,
that was,
yes,
entered into the history of Karbala and into the history of Islam.
Very good.
And they were some clues for, you know, modernists to, you know, point out these problems in the history of Islam,
that's
in
right,
the books, and they say, okay, because these ones are maybe fake, so maybe the other points that are mentioned in your historical books are also fake.
Fake too, that's right.
So Mr. Ayati and the other figures on those moments were trying to stand against this approach,
that's
of
right,
the modernists. So
okay,
this is the,
yeah,
work that they were trying to do. I believe that they, alhamdulillah,
were
successful,
they were successful
to defend,
okay,
the core of the Islamic belief and the religion of Islam.
That's right.
Because the fundamentals and the principles are different. I mean, when you look at the narrative sciences and the